I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, a deadly bombing in Afghanistan at the Indian Embassy and protests in the streets in Pakistan underscore a problem facing Washington. The Taliban claimed responsibility for the bombing, but did that attack originate in Pakistan? And why are Pakistanis protesting a $1.5 billion U.S. aid package, the so-called Kerry Lugar bill, by burning American flags in the street? Earlier, we reached Zafar Abbas, editor of Dawn, the largest English-language newspaper in Pakistan.
According to a large number of opposition politicians, it is an insult to Pakistan that dictation is given by Washington that you fulfill these conditions or the aid will not be given to you.
Daniel Markey is a Pakistan expert at the Council on Foreign Relations. Daniel, what do you think is happening here? Is Pakistan feeling the Washington spotlight shift from Afghanistan to them?
Well, I think Pakistan has felt that spotlight for a number of years now, and this is just the latest move. Obviously, the Obama administration's perspective on the region is shaped very much by its interest in al-Qaeda, and everybody agrees that al-Qaeda is in Pakistan. So for that reason, some of the attention has shifted from the straight-up Afghanistan question of troops and so on to how do we deal with that deeper global threat that is based in Pakistan.
Well, some of the conditions that were attached to the U.S. bill included that Pakistan cooperate in dismantling the networks set up by the scientist A.Q. Khan to ship nuclear weapons material out of the country, that the Pakistan government make sustained efforts at combating militants and bases on the border with Afghanistan, and that the Pakistani security forces not be materially or substantially subverting political or judicial processes. Seem like pretty reasonable requests for $1.5 billion.
Well, they do, and I think that that's the attitude taken by those on the Hill who drafted these so-called conditions. They really aren't conditions that require much of Pakistan that it shouldn't or wouldn't likely be doing anyway. That said, the Pakistanis have been and will continue to be very sensitive to anything that looks like outside dictation. And that's how many of them read this legislation.
Well, and as we said, we spoke to Zafar Abbas, who's editor of Dawn, the English-language newspaper in Pakistan. They ran an editorial against the aid bill, in part because they alluded to interference that might interrupt the transition to democracy. Isn't there a concern that if the U.S. pushes the Pakistan government too much, it might make them even more vulnerable to a takeover by the Pakistan military?
Yeah, I think some people view this bill as some in Pakistan worry that by drawing too close to the current government of President Zardari, Prime Minister Gilani, that Washington actually weakens them and that they'd be better off if they didn't appear so dependent upon outside support. This is the problem of miscommunication, and I think at some level there's also a certain amount of political motivation on the Pakistani side among the opposition parties who are looking to tar the government with being too close to Washington.
Well, and we're also hearing reports from people like David Ignatius in the Washington Post that Pakistan is working hard and having real success in changing people's minds about the Taliban in places like the Swat Valley, almost deprogramming programs. And the government is also initiating a new campaign against insurgents in South Waziristan. And some Pakistanis feel they're being unfairly criticized, that they're doing the best they can.
I think there's some truth to that. Look, there's a difference of opinion with respect to certain militant groups where the United States feels that Pakistan isn't doing enough. That said, Pakistan has done more with respect to some of these militant outfits, the Pakistani Taliban in the Swat Valley and so on, and deserves credit for that, rightly. And the past 6 months have actually been relatively more positive, certainly than anything we saw of the preceding couple of years.
Well, and Daniel Markey, just one last question in the few seconds we have. How are you reading the tea leaves, the smoke signals coming out of the White House? How much do you think the U.S. may switch policy? How much will they target the nuclear-armed Pakistan?
I think the reality is, as the Obama administration has said, they don't intend to draw down troops in Afghanistan precipitously. With respect to Pakistan, the hope was that focusing on building up Pakistani civilian institutions, providing all kinds of civilian assistance in the form of this Kerry Lugar legislation would be a positive step. And I go back to saying there is surprise here in Washington that the Pakistanis are responding so violently and negatively to what was perceived as a partnership-building approach by the U.S. Congress.
Daniel Markey, Senior Fellow on India, Pakistan, and South Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations. Daniel, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, we've heard the story of the addicts who stay up all night online. Ultimately, there may be a family intervention, rehab. In a few minutes, we'll hear that story. But first, here's another. Lucy Ferris is a writer in residence at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. Her 20-year-old son, Dan, was a scholar athlete playing Division I tennis at Old Dominion University in Virginia. But he ultimately dropped out to play online poker full-time. After a huge confrontation with his mom, Dan began to get his act together, treat his poker playing professionally. He traveled to Germany for a tournament, made it to one of the later rounds, and now his mother has come to an uneasy acceptance of his choices. She joins us from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in Hartford. Lucy, start back at the beginning when your son started to change. What did you see?
I began to see absolutely nothing of him during the day. He was awake all night, went to bed just about the time I was getting up in the morning. And that was a significant change.
Yeah, he had been a golden boy. He was a tennis player at Old Dominion. And it became clear when he was in school something was distracting him. But when you asked him about it, did he tell you he was online gambling?
Well, I should say first that he had played poker in our basement for many years with his friends. It seemed like a pretty healthy activity to me at the time. I suspected he was playing online, but I really didn't know anything about that world. So it wasn't until it was clear that he was up all night staring at his computer that I began to think that this was the world that he was becoming involved in.
Right. This was a summer when he had come home. You and his father had divorced. You sent him to his father's house, and his father at first poo-pooed that there was a problem and then called you to say he's out of control. And there was a moment when it all exploded.
Well, I had said to him toward the end of summer, look, you've been up all night playing poker, sleeping all day. How do you expect to attend classes and be an athlete? And that was the point at which he said to me, oh, I haven't been playing poker. I've just been up watching videos. So the first thing I did was to ask him to prove it to me. I knew enough by then to know that he couldn't play online poker with an American bank account. He had to have some sort of account overseas.
Why is that?
Because ever since 2006, when Congress passed something called the Unlawful Internet Gambling Enforcement Act, the burden has been on American financial institutions not to send money to online gambling websites, all of which are located offshore. So anybody who wants to play Texas Hold'em or wants to just play a game of craps has to send the money somehow overseas without going directly through an American bank. So I knew that Dan had something like that, and he proceeded to show me such accounts, and they were virtually empty. And something about that smelled very, very fishy.
So you did something that is sweaty palm inducing. What did you do?
One thing that I knew was that Dan had gone into my computer at one point to check his email and had asked my computer to save his password. So at 4 o'clock in the morning, I did something that seemed reprehensible to me. I logged onto his email account because it occurred to me that the website that he had shown me was not the only website that he was playing on. And sure enough, I found correspondence to a different screen name from a different website. And I proceeded to log onto that website as Dan.
And saw?
And I saw that he had $12,000 in poker winnings. So I didn't touch the money. I locked the account. I changed the password so that Dan would be forced to talk to me.
Well, he did more than that. he found out you were pulling out of the driveway with a friend. He came out, ripped the windshield wiper off the car.
Right. It was his usual wake-up time, which is about 5:30 in the afternoon. Huh. And he came barreling out of the house, screaming that I had stolen his money. And he proceeded to rip the windshield wiper off the back of the car and plant himself in front of the car, challenging me to run him over. And I didn't, obviously, run him over, but I did manage to get out of the driveway.
Okay, so something at this point is terribly wrong, and now you're still in this. It's a familiar framework of a story to many people whose loved ones are addicts. His grades dive, he finally quits the tennis team, and you start speaking to people who know a lot about poker, who say, look, you know, in most cases, this doesn't end well.
But right,
then,
exactly.
But then what happens?
Well, what seemed most important to me was that Dan and I opened up the lines of communication. And so long as he was making money off of this enterprise, there wasn't a darn thing I could do about it. It also seemed to me that Dan was starting to do something that he had needed to do. Counselors had told me for years that he needed to do it. He needed to separate in some way from me. And if I looked at what he was doing, this playing poker, as a successful attempt to separate, then I might find a way in which I could keep the lines of communication open.
Even as you spoke to, for instance, the executive director of the National Council on Problem Gambling, who said poker's gambling. It's always gambling. It involves the same three things, prize, chance, and consideration. It's not sport. It's not Scrabble.
I think the important thing about what Keith White, who's the director of the National Council on Problem Gambling, said to me is that you can admit that it's gambling and then sort of say, well, so what? So a lot of things are gambling. The stock market is gambling, if you use those three criteria. The problem is that we look on gambling as a negative activity, as a vice. And if we think of it as an activity that can be healthy and as an activity that can be very unhealthy, then we stand a chance of helping people for whom the activity has become unhealthy.
Well, as you start to see it as maybe a form of his being able to separate from you and from the burden of being the golden boy scholar athlete, perhaps, who knows,
right. That
was the thing that you needed to sort of hold on to, as you write, a morsel of sanity. As he starts to feel your disapproval melt, what happens to him? What's he start to say?
Well, I have to say that actually the thing that seemed to me to turn it around was my beginning to write an article about this. Because I said to him, look, yes, I'm your mother, but I'd like to talk to you as if I'm a journalist. I'd like to learn more. And he began to relax. And he shared some things about his feelings, his ambitions, what he thought he was getting from poker that he never would have shared before.
And also, he does quite well at this. He plays tournaments, and there's a part of you that has some pride in him.
When your child is doing well at something that your child enjoys, it's very hard not to share emotionally in that happiness. So, yes, I have a constant push-pull of emotions. I still, in many, many ways, wish that he would follow a life that would not have the risk of taking him over this way. At the same time, boy, to see it, that a grin on your kid's face is a good thing.
We're talking with Lucy Ferris, whose son Dan was a college scholar athlete who played Division I tennis. When he dropped out to play online poker full-time and wasn't taking care of himself, sleeping during the day, staying up all night, he then got his act together and at one point told his mom, it's not like I'm leaving college for poker. It's more that poker's allowed me to leave a situation that wasn't good for me, college. But Lucy, your son has now gone back to college while still gambling. So how'd this happen?
Dan now has a sponsor, which takes some of the financial stress off of him. And at the same time, just a couple of months ago, he made a decision that floored me. He decided that he wanted to try going back to school, and what's more, he wanted to try going back to school at Trinity College, which is where I teach.
So much for separating from you.
Well, I think he maybe felt that he could do that because he had separated from me. I think he may also have realized that one of the things that was missing in his academic experience was the kind of challenge that he was getting from poker. I think he's also been lonely for his peer group.
Well, and so is he going to give up poker or gambling completely?
I think it's an open question whether Dan has the discipline to shut the computer down when he needs to study. But he's getting his feet wet slowly.
And do you worry that the day might come where you're saying, gosh, why didn't we do an intervention back then? Why did I compromise?
I do. I'm always presenting myself with different alternatives of what I could do. In other words, do I have any power for good in this situation? And it seems to me that I don't. When I wrote the article for the New York Times, there were some parents who said, well, I wouldn't put up with any such a thing. I would march my kid down to an intervention right away. My response to that is, and then your kid would not talk to you. And you would not be able to do that because your son is over 18 years old. And when your son wants and needs somebody to talk to you, you need to be there. So I feel as though Dan is in a much better place now than he was 12 months ago. That doesn't mean that the dangers aren't out there.
That's Lucy Ferris, writer in residence at Trinity College and also mother of 20-year-old Dan, and she watches from the sidelines as he continues a life of now a professional gambler. Lucy, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, but there are other families who say they can't live with online gambling, online anything. They say it becomes an unhealthy addiction. And now the first residential internet addiction center in the U.S. recently opened. It's in Fall City, Washington. It's called the Restart Internet Addiction Recovery Program. Dr. Hillary Cash is co-founder. Dr. Cash, we should say that internet addiction is not recognized as an addiction by the American Psychiatric Association. But you say that, like other addictions, the problem is people do get a high, maybe from going on Facebook for a few hours, and then that wears away and they have to spend more time to keep achieving that feeling. How bad have you seen it get?
Well, of course, for most people, they are going to be able to just pull back and have it be a normal part of their lives. But for those people who are not able to do that, these are people who will flunk out of high school, flunk out of college, do a great deal of lying, sometimes becoming violent in order to keep their computers from being taken away, and oftentimes become severely depressed and anxious.
And possibly suicidal, we read?
Yes, indeed.
Is it true that some gamers have died after playing for days?
It has happened. The stories that I'm aware of have occurred in some of the Asian countries, and these are individuals who have stayed in front of their computers for more than 40 hours at a time. And I think they're dying from blood clots.
Well, and we understand that China is addressing what they see as a problem with online addicts, but they have boot camps where actually people have died in the boot camps because of beatings. Obviously, you don't do that. What does Restart do?
Restart is designed to, first of all, give people 45 days without access to the Internet.
Is that hard, cold turkey like that?
It is, of course, hard because people go into withdrawal and they feel anxious and uncomfortable, both physically and psychologically.
You call it a cyber fast.
Exactly. Right. In addition, we're really designing an individualized program for each person to help build up the strengths that they need in order to be successful in their adult lives.
They might go on some outdoor expedition. I see a picture of a young man having, you know, holding a puppy, so he has some interaction with a living thing. But
right.
You know that there's some criticism. Dr. Bruce Ballin of the Center for Addiction and Mental Health in Toronto says that the fact that your program focuses on the Internet might detract from some other issue, that the Internet's just the symptom.
When you stop finally engaging in the addictive behavior, then you have the opportunity to start looking at underlying causes. For some people, they may have truly some other co-occurring disorder that has to be addressed, or there just might be psychodynamic reasons, anger, disappointment in life that is driving that, and you begin addressing it.
Well, how do you send them back into the real world? People might be able to avoid a bar or situations where there's alcohol, for instance, if they have to give that up. But many people, to work today, have to work on a computer.
For most people, working is not their application that's addictive. What people need to make a commitment to, and what our clients, and when they leave, make a commitment to, is avoiding those applications to which they are addicted, whether it is video games or pornography. There are triggers that stimulate craving, and they need to have a plan for how to avoid those triggers. So having a support network, a therapist, family, we have started a 12-step program called Internet and Technology Addicts Anonymous. So we encourage people, when they return back home, to start a 12-step support group.
That's Dr. Hillary Cash, co-founder of the Restart Internet Addiction Recovery Program there in Falls City, Washington. She's also written a book on video games and is co-founder of an addiction service for companies. Dr. Cash, thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, Moses led the Jews to the Promised Land, but did he also inspire Americans from George Washington to Barack Obama, not to mention slaves on the Underground Railroad, and Superman? We'll speak with author Bruce Feiler about his terrific new book on Moses. That's tomorrow. Still to come today, why businesses are breaking with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce over climate change. That's after the latest news, Here and Now. Have you thought about your final resting place? Well, according to Forbes.com, the cost of an average burial plot here in the U.S. is around $4,000. In Japan, traditional burial plots are even more expensive. There, they can cost tens of thousands of dollars. So some people are turning to a cheaper, high-tech alternative. The BBC's Roland Burke reports from Tokyo.
In Japan's crowded cities, there's little space for the dead. But by this station in Tokyo is what may be a solution. It's a grey building. It looks rather like an apartment block, about five or six stories high. There aren't many windows, though, because this is nothing less than a graveyard in the sky. Inside, a Buddhist monk, Ryo Toku Ohora, is chanting a prayer in front of an altar. It isn't a funeral, but the start of a sales pitch for potential customers visiting this recently built multi-story graveyard. He explains how the ashes of the dead are kept in urns on shelves in a vault with a robotic arm to retrieve them for remembrance ceremonies.
With this kind of system, we can store a lot of remains so you don't have to visit a graveyard far away. And it's convenient because it's beside the station.
And how much does it cost compared to a normal graveyard?
The cost will be half or a third of a normal graveyard in Tokyo, because we can store many remains compared to a normal graveyard. So we can offer a reasonable price.
It's 380,000 yen, around $4,000. Which might not seem cheap, but is a bargain for a final resting place in Japan. Ryo Toku Ohora shows me around.
So we're now going back into the workings of this building, where the ashes are actually kept. Back here it's quite high-tech with some computer screens, but there's also racks where the rectangular urns can be kept, and they're stretching up into the darkness up in the top of the building.
These are the shelves where we store the urns, and there's an automated crane inside.
So there's a huge crane now moving between these shelves of urns, and it's very rapidly collecting the one that's obviously been selected by someone upstairs. It's a real warehouse for the dead. How many people can be in here?
You can put ashes for two people in one box, so 7,000 people maximum in this space. For normal graveyard, you should get 100 graves in this area.
So presumably this is where people would come if they wanted to pay tribute to their loved ones. There's a kind of computer in one corner, and in front of us there's a screen of frosted glass.
This is where you come to visit the grave. You touch the panel, and then the window will open and you'll see your urn.
So the screen goes back and there's a black marble gravestone there, and the urn sort of appears in the middle of it. And in front of the gravestone there's a small water fountain, and there's some pictures as well of the deceased on an electronic photo frame that have appeared too. And the whole thing is set off by two vases of flowers on either side. There's a space in front to burn incense too.
Salespeople show off the system to prospective customers using swipe cards and the touch screen to summon up urns to the mourning rooms.
Our family grave is outside. Sometimes it rains and there's a strong wind and you have to fix the graveyard.
One of the things to consider is the price. It's reasonable, and I think it would be nice to be stored with other people. It's more fun, there'll be company.
The Japanese have turned to technology for solutions to many of the problems of life, and now death too. 300 families have placed the ashes of their loved ones in the building so far. With high-tech graveyards being built across Japan, it's no longer an outlandish option. And the monk expects the remaining slots on the shelves will soon be occupied.
That's the BBC's Roland Burke in Tokyo. Well, up next, Mr. Malink goes to Washington. His neighbors may know this Ohio businessman, but now he's been in Washington pushing for climate change legislation. We'll find out why. That's in 30 seconds, here and now. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill got an earful this week from groups urging passage of a federal cap on emissions that contribute to climate change. But this wasn't the usual crowd of protesters dressed in polar bear costumes. It was a coalition of more than 150 business executives, all part of a lobbying blitz by business leaders. Some, yes, producing an alternative energy product, but some also leading energy providers, Exelon, Public Service Electric and Gas, Duke Energy, National Grid, who all say they can't afford to sidestep the climate and energy challenge. In fact, some companies have broken with the traditional business representative, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, over this issue. Stephen Malink was in Washington. He's the owner of the Malink Corporation. They offer consulting services and products to help companies bring down energy costs, and they say they walk the walk. He says retrofitting his own building has saved him energy costs up to 70%. But Steve, what about manufacturers, people with smokestacks, people who make things? Won't this cost them?
You know, there are a lot of very large manufacturers who are proponents of this legislation, you know, ranging from General Electric, HP, Sharp, Dow Chemical.
Well, in fact, you talked to people at this meeting who operate manufacturing facilities and power plants who'd be directly affected by any legislation. And what did some of them say to you about their other concerns?
I got to hear Jim Rogers, CEO of Duke Energy, one of the largest utilities in the country, for example. And his point is very clear. I mean, he wants to make sure the rules of the game are made clear so he knows how to invest in new power plants going forward.
He and others have power plants that have to be decommissioned. And what did he say to you about that?
He's saying by the year 2050, he has to decommission, you know, all the plants that are currently in operation to replace with newer, more efficient equipment. And he just needs to know today, or as soon as possible, how to make plans going forward on what that equipment will be.
Right. They have to know what the federal game plan is going to be. So there's a push on that level. And we understand other energy providers are looking over their shoulder at China.
Yes. You know, I read an article by Thomas Friedman just a week or so ago, and he made the analogy that this is our generation's Sputnik. Now we're approaching an era where we might be losing our competitiveness to a emerging world power named China.
Well, the Energy Secretary, Stephen Chu, who's also a Nobel Prize winner, spoke of the fact that China invests some $12.6 million in clean energy every hour.
Yes. They have made a much larger commitment as a country to embrace the new energy economy than the U.S. has.
Well, if Congress doesn't pass climate change legislation this session, the Obama administration has said it's going to instruct the EPA to regulate greenhouse gas emissions with or without congressional approval. We know that many, and you're among them, feel that's not the way to go, that what has to happen is a national energy policy with incentives to be more green. But I just want to ask about one of those incentives, the cap and trade system, much under debate. This is the idea that of businesses being able to buy and sell sort of carbon credits. If they do well and curb their pollution, then they have some extra credits to sell and they make some money.
Yes.
How do you feel about that? Because some say that's why businesses are moving forward on this issue. They're seeing that as a way to make money.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a market-based approach to addressing the problem.
What about one of the criticisms of cap and trade, which is that wealthier companies will fare better and won't be forced to cut emissions if they have a lot of money and can sort of just pay for their polluting?
I think our company, in a small way, serves as a microcosm of what is possible to show how one can not only survive in becoming more energy efficient, but actually thrive. So I think there's a lot of fear-mongering going on out there about you know, it's just going to create job loss, but our experience has not shown that.
Because, you know, some are saying, you know, rather than cap and trade, which again allows wealthy companies to just, you know, pay for going over the cap, why not have a carbon tax so they have to pay for what they emit?
You know, my take on it is that the word tax would be, you know, a politically unacceptable approach to the problem, but I think a more market-based approach is the better route to go.
Well, and this lobbying blitz that you were part of in Washington also has highlighted something of a split in the business community over climate change. High-profile energy providers like Exelon, Pacific Gas, companies like Apple Computer have quit their membership in the U.S. Chamber of Commerce because of the chamber's stand against climate change legislation. The chamber says it's a jobs killer. The chamber's vice president, William Kovacs, has gone so far as to call for a Scopes monkey trial over global warming because he says the science needs to be put on trial. Are you seeing some sort of a tipping point in the business community?
I am seeing growing momentum towards those that are embracing this as the opportunity it is from an economic standpoint, from an energy independence standpoint, and an environmental health standpoint. You know, it's amazing that 30-plus years after our first energy crisis, we're still here kind of dithering as a nation whether or not we should get serious about energy. It's unfortunate that, you know, such a strong stance has been taken at the national level by the chamber, because I don't think it's representative of most of its members. I think that there is a major shift occurring.
That's Steve Malink. He's owner of the Malink Corporation in Milford, Ohio. Their company helps other businesses become more energy efficient, and they're trying to also practice what they preach. Steve, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, and a quick note on a story we're investigating. President Obama has been referred to as baller-in-chief, and today he'll be spending a lot of time watching and playing hoops. This afternoon, the president will drop by the White House basketball court to watch the National Naval Medical Center's Marine Wounded Warrior basketball team as they play. Later today, he'll blow off some steam by taking to the court with some members of Congress and cabinet members. And the roster looks like it's all guys. The Treasury Secretary, Tim Geithner, Democratic Congressman Heath Shuler of North Carolina, Brad Ellsworth of Indiana, Republican Jeff Flake of Arizona. Obama aides told Politics Daily that the president hopes some male bonding will help him with his legislative agenda. Wait a minute, where are the women? Where's Michelle, a known hoop fan? Her brother is a basketball coach. He had a play with Obama to see if he had game before he'd sign off on Obama dating his sister. Well, we called the White House, and the press office said they're looking into how the teams were chosen, but they also added the president played hoops earlier this year with the championship UConn women's Husky team when they were honored at the White House. Does that count? Male bonding. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this or anything on the program. Just go to hereandnow.org. You can click on Contact Us up in the right corner there. That helps you send an email or make a phone call. Or you can scroll down and leave a comment right there on the homepage. We'd love to hear from you again, hereandnow.org. You're listening to Here and Now, back in 1 minute. Welcome back.
Can't give up acting tough. It's all that I'm made of. Can't scrape together quite enough to ride the bus to the outskirts of the fact that I need love.
That's Nico Case with the title track off her latest CD, Middle Cyclone. She's a terrific singer-songwriter. And wait, wait, don't tell me, guest. You may have heard her on the NPR program. They call her possibly our favorite Not My Job guest of the year. That's the segment where people answer questions about things that, well, aren't their job. And she had tremendous knowledge of Civil War history and the New England Confectionery Company's Necco wafers. It turns out the wafers were originally made as sustenance for Union soldiers. Host Peter Sagal questioned Nico about other Necco trivia.
Here we go. What exactly are the purple ones supposed to taste like? Is it A, beet, B, clove, or C, steak?
I'm going to go with B, clove.
And you're right. They are clove-flavored candy.
That's a wafer's under his saddle. And he wasn't in battle, which he never was.
General Lee's plans for the Battle of Antietam were found on a Necco wafer's wrapper. All right.
Curse their Yankee candy.
This weekend, Nico Case will make her first ever appearance on A Prairie Home Companion. Hilarity and good music should abound there as well. Middle Cyclone is her sixth solo CD. Critics have called it ambitious and complex. Well, with all the recent attention, we thought we'd reprise our conversation with Nico Case from this past April. It began with a question about This Tornado Loves You. It's the lead track on the CD, and Nico describes it as a tornado love story.
Yeah, I had a dream where I was approached by a tornado, and I was really terrified. But the tornado, I realized, wanted me to read it a book. And the exciting thing about the dream was that the tornado had to figure out how to kind of calm down and ask me for what it wanted in a way that I would be receptive. So watching the tornado kind of shift its gears and figure out how to interact with a human being was very moving, I thought.
In your dream, and in your song, you give the tornado a backstory and a personality and a broken heart. Let's listen.
I've waited with a glacier's pain. Smashed every transformer with every trailer till nothing was standing. 65 miles wide. Still you are nowhere, still you are nowhere, nowhere inside.
Tornadoes, cyclones, glaciers, wind, rain. Nature, a theme. What is that about?
I don't know. I'm just a fan of nature and animals and I'm always paying attention to how much people try to separate themselves from nature. It's kind of like there's been this cultural repression of instinct for centuries, and it's kind of interesting to see how that's shaped us.
Well, you mentioned animals as well. We know you've adopted 3 greyhound dogs, rescued them from a racetrack, animal rights, one of your causes. One of your new songs, People Got a Lot of Nerve, speaks directly to the mistreatment of animals by humans. Here's a verse written to handlers of a killer whale at an aquarium. Let's listen.
You know, they call them killer whales, but you seem surprised when it pinned you down to the bottom of the tank where you can't turn around. It took half your leg and both your lungs. When I crave thy hearts of sharks, I know you're it. I'm a man, 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 man.
The song was just a reaction to the fact that there were so many animal maulings in the last couple years in zoos and whatnot. And people on the news act so shocked. Like when the guy climbed in with the tiger and then the tiger killed him.
Yeah.
It's like, the tiger didn't even kill him right away. He was bugging him and then the tiger killed him. It's like, the people on the news are like, oh my, it's terrible. It's just terrible. They're going to have to kill the tiger. What did the tiger do? The tiger's already crazy living in a cage. I mean, and then some crazy frat guy gets in there. I would have killed him, too. I would have. I'm not saying that that guy deserved it. That's totally awful. Or maulings are awful. They're I mean, I do find them slightly funny, so I have to...
You're conflicted on this.
Well, I'm conflicted. But I just have a morbid sense of humor. I don't think it should really happen in real life, but in a Far Side kind of way, you know, a Gary Larson kind of way, I do find it kind of funny.
Well, as you say in another song on your CD, Never Turn Your Back on Mother Earth, this is the 70s group Sparks song that you cover and fits right into, you know, the theme. But you also cover Harry Nilsson's Don't Forget Me. Let's just listen to a little of that.
Don't forget me. Don't forget. About you, let me know you think about me too.
those cascading pianos, six in all, you got for free on Craigslist and fixed up there in the barn on the old dairy farm in Vermont, which you're renovating and moving into soon. And also joining your happy crowd in Vermont, frogs. We're big frog fans. You recorded frogs on your Vermont property and put them under the title, now you have to say this for me,
Marais la Nuit,
meaning?
It means swamp at night or marsh at night. I can't remember which one. The frogs were so over the top, and they were feeling all matey. It was mating season.
We call them spring peepers here.
Spring peepers. Yeah. Yeah. Love them. And so I went down with my little handheld recorder, and I got about 4 minutes of them that didn't have any of my corduroy pants going vroom, vroom, vroom. So, and I thought nobody would even notice the frogs, but it's really been probably the most asked question I've been asked on this record, which is kind of exciting.
Let's listen. Nico Case, I just want to ask you quickly about your CD cover. You're in a dress, you're barefoot, on the hood of an old Mercury Cougar. You got a sword in your hand, looking defiant, and also looking a little bit like that redhead from Desperate Housewives.
Is my forehead really that huge?
Do you mean the desperate? No, I mean it's
later
sort of like...
Kelly's going to get out a projector and project a movie on my forehead.
You're very attractive. You know, I'm trying to get across an image.
Just kidding. I don't know why I said that.
What is the image you're trying to project?
Well, I really hate getting my picture taken, and so I thought, what if I tried to be a different person? And I thought, well, what if I was an 8-year-old boy and I was making a record? You know, what would be the most awesome, kick-ass thing I could do? And I thought, I would want a sword and a wicked muscle car. I mean, an 8-year-old boy in the 70s anyway, when I grew up. So that's what I went with.
Well, we were also thinking of your song, I'm an Animal, which we're going to go out on with the line, I do my best, but I'm made of mistakes. And there are things I'm still so afraid of, but my courage is roaring like the sound of the sun. Maybe something a little boy would say. Nico Case, her new CD is Middle Cyclone. For more, you can go to our website, herenow.org. Nico, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.